The man nodded. At sundown. I was just going out for some bread. Sammy gouged two holes in the man's torso just under his arms to drain the blood from his lungs. The man screamed. He'd been given a small dose of anesthesia, but because anesthesia was one of the things the hospital had too little of, no one gave him more.
"Allahu Akbar," cried the man.
"Give me more light," said Sammy. An assistant changed the angle of the lamp over the man's body while two more men, one on either side of him, held him down. My brother fed tubes into the holes under his arms and then adjusted their position so that the man's skin was drawn away from his ribcage this way and that, like silly putty.
"No Muslim would do this to another Muslim," cried the man. "My son, he is two. His face was blown off. Why are they doing this? Why?"
Sammy sunk a syringe into the man's abdomen. When he began digging around in the intubated holes again, I closed my eyes and turned to leave. About half an hour later, when I looked back into the operating theater, it was empty. In the doctor's mess, the television had been turned off, and two men waiting for a kettle to boil were arguing over whether Saddam's capture for 4 days earlier was real or a lie propagated by the Americans for publicity. I found my father and brother back in the lobby, standing over the boy with the bloody legs, my father with his arm folded as if he were cold, and my brother smoking. Another doctor stood beside Sammy, also smoking. Walid, I guessed. On the other side of the gurney stood three more men, two in dishdashas, and the third in a red and white keffiyeh, knotted under a thick black beard. "We found him on Wathik," one of the men was saying. "Says he lives near Zayuna. Says his name is Mustafa. Says he hasn't seen his parents since last week." It wasn't until that point that I looked more closely at the men standing over the boy, who even as he was being discussed continued his preternatural blinking at the wall, and saw that the one with the very black beard and the red and white scarf tied around his neck was Alistair. "Please notes," reads a sign taped to the front door of the Alhambra. "Guns must be left at security desk. Thanks for your cooperation." Inside, a man wearing a camel-colored turtleneck sat at the hotel's receptionist desk doing a crossword in Arabic. On his desk were a pocket watch, a security wand, and a Kalashnikov, the barrel of which lay aimed at my groin as Sammy and I lifted our arms to be frisked. Through a pair of heavy wooden doors, the journalist's Christmas party was already underway. The restaurant's red walls, red tablecloths, and dimly glowing wall sconces all suggested a supper club in purgatory. In one corner, two waiters in bow ties stood quietly at attention, the fabric of their shirts so thin you could plainly see the outline of their tank tops underneath. In another corner, a third Iraqi sat playing big band standards on a piano. The instrument was a blonde old upright that faced into the room, its crisscrossed innards partly veiled by a floral print curtain that matched those on the windows. Although it was dark outside and the hotel's window panes had been reinforced with dense argyle iron grids, there might as well have been no windows at all. In the center of the room, a crowd of correspondents, cameramen, photographers, and contractors mingled festively, pouring drinks and cutting cigars. Most of them were men, although there were also a few women present, including one in tight white jeans being cornered by a man who, in a French accent, was explaining how the situation was not unlike Vietnam. You try to crush the resistance, and in doing so, you inflame the neutral population. We found Alistair out by the pool, sitting at a candlelit table cluttered with bottles and ashtrays, and talking to a young American man whose hat identified him as the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. Each man was working his way through a cigar, the American rather less adroitly, and because Alistair was no longer wearing his kefe, I saw now that while his beard was real, the black was not. "Anyone who was paying attention in the 90s, he was saying, "anyone who learned anything from Yugoslavia, Bosnia, and Somalia would have anticipated this. If you disband the military, if you fire everyone who ever worked for the government, if you take away people's jobs, their income, and their pride, what do you expect? That they're going to sit around playing Parcheesi until you show up at their door and hand them a ballot? And if they know where the old munitions are hidden, and you aren't guarding those either, is it really a surprise when they turn them against you?"
In the pool, a series of fluorescent deck lamps reflected like a row of shimmering moons. A chin-ups bar had been installed on the far side of the water, where, as we talked, an impressively muscled silhouette strode over, sprang up, and began vigorously pistoning himself into the air. The UNHCR man, who had a southern accent and continuously shifted his cigar from one hand to the other, as though even its unlit end were unbearably hot, said,
"Well, what choice did we have?"
"For that matter," said one of the other Americans, "why wasn't anything done sooner? Like when Saddam was murdering Kurds and Shiites for staging rebellion at our own not-so-subtle suggestion, leading to thousands of them being killed right under our noses because our troops were under inexplicable orders not to intervene, even though they were there, even though the attack arguably breached Schwarzkopf's ceasefire treaty. Why didn't we do anything then?"
"You sound like an exceptionalist," said Alistair.
"So?" said the American. "Exceptionalism is only a problem when it's used to justify bad policies. Ignorance is a problem. Complacency is a problem. But to aspire to exceptional behavior, exceptionally generous, judicious, humane behavior, as anyone lucky enough to have been born in an exceptionally rich, exceptionally educated, exceptionally democratic country should do?" The man in the UNHCR cap nodded sagely and blew smoke rings that stretched oblong before dissolving into the collective haze above the pool. Less than 2 years later, the same pool would have the body parts of suicide bombers floating in it. But on this night, an Iraqi Christmas of relative calm, Saddam had been captured, and it was impossible not to hope that the arc of the moral universe was not, after all, so very long and unyielding. I watched my brother light a cigarette without taking his eyes off the man on the pull-ups bar, and thought maybe he wasn't listening to the conversation, or listening but dismissing it as unworthy of his own participation. But then, still with his eyes on the exercising silhouette, Sammy exhaled and said, "Isn't it possible that what the West really wants is simply not to be inconvenienced by the Middle East? Not to be terrorized, not to be charged too much for its gas, not to be threatened with chemical or nuclear weapons. And otherwise, you couldn't really care less?"
"No," said the man with the UNHCR. "I believe the average American is sincere when he says he wants Iraq to become a peaceful and democratic nation. A free and secular nation. Though we understand this may not be possible for some time.
But you wouldn't want us to become richer than you, more powerful than you, to have international clout and the same seemingly boundless potential." The man in the UNHCR cap looked nonplussed.
"Well," Alistair put in quietly, "it's hard to imagine. But it would make for an interesting development, geopolitically speaking, yes?"
Inside, the journalists, cameramen, and contractors were sitting around one long table now, carving up a honey-baked ham someone's mother had FedExed from Maine. I sat down with Alistair at one end of the table, where two plates of meat were passed down to us, and Alistair ate them both. While he did, I noted that he seemed more alive than when I'd last seen him, which had been in London 5 years earlier. His body now appeared more charged and alert, as though, casualties aside, he really rather preferred life in a war zone. I asked whether it did occasionally feel hypocritical to be censorious of a war while at the same time drawn to its energies. Still chewing, Alistair nodded and said,
"Yes, it's true. There's something thrilling, addictive even, about the idea you're living every moment only half a step ahead of death. But if it weren't for those willing to do it, those willing to risk their lives to witness and record what's happening, how would the rest of us know what our governments are doing in our names?"
I pointed out that the very proliferation of pseudo-journalism these days, the cacophony of conjecture and partisan agendas and sensationalism that seem orchestrated above all to provoke and entertain, tended to leave me feeling as though I know less than ever what my government is doing in my name. Drinking, Alistair shrugged and nodded as if to concede.
"Yes, well, there's always the moronic inferno."
It was also on this night that Alistair told me about how, 8 years earlier in Kabul, he and his crew had been packing up after a segment when an Afghan boy darted over and snatched his cameraman's bag. A few minutes later, a policeman happened by and Alistair stopped him to describe the boy. 5'7" maybe, 14 or 15, wearing a light blue shirt and a dark green chemise. Went that away. A few minutes later, the policeman returned with the boy and handed Alistair the bag. Alistair thanked him, and the policeman told the boy to apologize, which the boy did. Then the policeman drew his pistol from his holster and shot the boy in the head. "You can imagine," said Alistair, "the number of times I've replayed that scene in my mind and regretted my unwilling participation. And if it's violence driving up your employee's advertising revenue, and you're the one reporting the violence, it's hard to see how in that respect, too, you aren't one of the ones perpetuating the violence. So, no, I don't always sleep soundly at night. But if I quit, which I considered very seriously after that day, I think I'd go mad from the alternative. When I'm working, when I'm high on adrenaline, I'm not exactly in what you would call a contemplative state. But when I go home, when I go out to dinner or sit on the tube or watch my trolley around Waitrose with all the other punters and their meticulous lists, I start to spin out. You observe what people do with their freedom, what they don't do, and it's impossible not to judge them for it. You come to see a most peaceful and democratic society as being in a state of incredibly delicate suspension, suspension that requires equilibrium down to the smallest molecule, such that even the tiniest jolt, just one person neglecting its fragility, with her complacency or self-absorption, could cause the whole fucking thing to collapse. You think about how we all belong to this species, capable of such horrifying evil, and you wonder what your responsibility to humanity is while you're here, and what sort of game God is playing with us. Not to mention what it means that generally you'd prefer to be back in Baghdad than at home in Angel with your wife and son reading If You Give a Mouse a Cookie. If I am unnerved by peace and contemplation, if something biochemical in me craves the stimulus of violent spectacle and proximity to conflict, where am I on that spectrum? What am I capable of under another set of circumstances? How different am I, really, from them? I didn't know you believe in God. I don't. Or rather, I'm agnostic. A foxhole agnostic. There's a Mandelson poem that goes, "Your form, agonizing and fleeting. I couldn't make it out in the haze." "God," I said by mistake, without having thought to speak. That about sums it up. You? Yeah. As in Allah? I nodded. Alistair lowered his beer. "What?" "Nothing. I just..." "You're an economist. A scientist." "I didn't know." Beside us, four men in flak jackets sat down with a deck of cards. It was one of those military issue packs with ranks compromising the 52 most wanted Ba'athist and revolutionary commanders. The game was Texas Hold'em, and Chemical Ali led the flop. Designed and distributed to familiarize American soldiers with the names and faces of those they've been charged with capturing or killing in a raid, the concept is a descendant of one also employed in the Second World War, when Air Force pilots played Jim Rummy with cards sporting the silhouettes of German and Japanese fighter aircraft. It's a curious tactic, this teaching of whom we should target and exterminate through a medium traditionally associated with playtime entertainment. One wonders whether the instructional advantage isn't undermined by the incendiary implication that, to Americans, war is akin to a game. In the one underway beside me, Saddam was the ace of spades. His sons, Qusay and Uday, that of clubs and hearts, respectively. And the only woman, the American-educated Hula Salimah Diamash, a.k.a. Chemical Sally, the five of hearts. 13 of the cards, including all four deuces, had in lieu of a photo only a generic black oval that resembled the outline of a head wearing a hood like the Grim Reaper's. And yet it was these cards, I thought, as the man nearest me laid down a flush, the cards without faces, that had the most humanizing effect. Maybe because their featurelessness was readily suggested that you, too, could have been born Adel Abdel Mehdi, Deuce of Diamonds, or Okle Ahmed Saklil Kubesi, Deuce of Clubs, or Qazim Hammoud El Abadi, Deuce of Hearts, or Rashid Tahan Qatem, Deuce of Spades. If only your great-grandfather had met a different woman. If only your parents had taken a later flight. If only your soul had sparked into being on a different continent. a different hemisphere, a different day. Meanwhile, the din of laughing and clinking and drunken caroling had begun to compete now with a slow but steady crescendo emanating from the piano in the corner. I looked up to see my brother there, sharing the instrument's bench with its hired player, each man looking after his own half of the keyboard while also carrying on a conversation that made their cigarettes bounce between their lips.
The music was no longer Cole Porter and Irving Berlin,
but instead a sort of jazz fever that had no beginning, middle, or end. Just the cycle of surges, looping swells and contractions, long frenetic improvisations that managed to sound both triumphant and apocalyptic at once. It reminded me, in places, of the sort of music that accompanies a silent movie brawl, or a Charlie Chaplin chase, or the headlines of history being peeled away one by one. And it went on late into the night, long after the ham had been finished and most of the journalists and contractors and cameramen had gone up to bed, long after the waiters had cleared the soiled tablecloths away and the camouflage-backed cards had gone back into their box, long after the cerulean pool had settled into a state-like glass, and the tiny column of ash on my brother's cigarette had grown long enough to bow downward and drop off. I put down Japanese Vogue and went over to the observation window through which I could see the guards trying to coax a bottle of juice out of the vending machine from where it had become trapped, mid-fall. When I tapped on the glass, the two men straightened up simultaneously, and the one nearer me lunged for the door. "Come to think of it," I said, "I could use something to drink." While they fetched me some water, a new officer, a man I hadn't seen previously, passed wordlessly through the antechamber into the holding room, where he approached the black man and sat down. As the officer spoke, the black man stared intently at the floor, rubbing his eyes and blinking reasonably. Something about Lagos. Eric Air. No mention of Miss Odeliki of Croydon. Holding my water, I sat down again a few yards away and resumed my analphabetic perusal of Vogue. It was time for Ash. Or past it. There was no telling that room lit exclusively by fluorescence. But under the circumstances, I decided best to remain where I was, inconspicuously upright, innocuously absorbed in my Kokoroka and chiffon. When the officer had left, several uneventful minutes passed. Then the black man got up, went into the male toilet, and began to moan. A moment later, the moaning became a thumping that grew louder and faster. I got up and went back to the observation window. Having liberated their juice, the guards were now sitting with their feet up on the table, chatting and passing a bag of potato chips between them. When they'd taken note of my presence and opened up again, I said, "I thought the man in the toilet might be hurting himself." The guards hurried past me and wrestled the man out by his arms. Then they dragged him to a seat, forced him down, and perched on either side of his body in an attempt to subdue its fitful writhing. Every now and again, the black man would endeavor to wrench free of them with a violent sideways jerk. Then he would collapse, head back and palms facing the ceiling, and in this position looked something like a martyr awaiting the stigmata. The guard seemed uncertain what to do next. One and then the other glanced in my direction, as if to gauge whether I might be sufficiently trustworthy to fetch a fifth party. Meanwhile, the muted television scrolled a headline about an apartment that had exploded in Yevpatoria.
A state of emergency had been declared in the Marshall Islands, and Suzuki was considering production cuts amidst the financial crisis.
Funny, I thought, how when you've been involuntarily subtracted from the world, its problems begin to seem less the random luck of a mostly innocent people and more the consequences of their own had-it-coming stupidity. And so we remained, me sipping my Avion by the door, the guards holding fast to their unpredictable Nigerian, until Denise, from whom I'd begun to feel an almost filial affection, returned at 5:10 with a cold curry chicken sandwich and a redhead named Duncan, who was going to take over my case because Denise's own shift was up. At first, Sulaymaniyah did not seem to me at all different from Baghdad. The nearest usable airport was a 14-hour drive and at least one international border crossing away. Slightly older than middle-aged men waddling around with their heads down and their hands clasped behind their backs, prayer beads dangling from three fingers. Most of the electrical power was being produced by backyard or rooftop generators. There was running water for only half the day, so as soon as it came on, people started filling the gigantic drums they'd placed on their roofs just for that purpose. Practically everyone smoked. Actually, that might be the entire list of similarities. Among the differences was language, for one. Our first morning there, walking in and search for a money changer, my father and I got as far as a block before I noticed how eerie it was that we could read all of the signs well enough to make out the letters and their pronunciations, but neither of us had a clue as to their significance. Both Kurdish and Arabic are spelled phonetically, and the alphabets are basically identical, although Kurdish, like Persian, has a handful more letters. So we were looking for a bank or a money changer and hoping that the words in Kurdish for bank or money changer were cognates with the Arabic. But we didn't find one until Sammy's Kurdish driver came and took us to one. The word for bank is the same, but the word for money changer is not. And while I have never learned the etymology behind this minor asymmetry, I can imagine it represents centuries of cultural and ideological dissonance. Another difference, security. There's a fork in the road not far from Dohuk. Bear right, and before long you're on the outskirts of Mosul. Bear left, and you remain well inside Kurdistan. Waving an American passport around would have yielded very different results depending on which way we went. We went left. This was not without cost. The drive to Sulaymaniyye from Zeho on the Iraqi-Turkish border took about 9 hours that way.
If we'd cut the corner and gone down to Mosul and then across to Kirkuk, it could have taken about 5.
That's if we would have arrived at all. My grandmother and cousin came up via Kirkuk, and it was a considerable concern whether Hussein would be able to carry both his American and Iraqi passports, without the wrong one being glimpsed on the wrong side of the Kurdish border. A year after my last visit to Iraq, we were in Kurdistan for my brother's engagement to Zahra, a recent University of Baghdad graduate who'd grown up in Sulaymaniyye, and persuaded Sammy to take a job at the teaching hospital there so they might start a family in the relatively peaceful north. Short of returning to Bay Ridge and establishing his own practice over the Irish ophthalmologist on 4th, my brother could not have made my parents much happier with this news. And I too felt a certain precipitous relief. 11 months earlier, a double suicide attack at the offices of Kurdistan's two main political parties had killed more than 100 people and wounded at least as many more. But even this contributed to an incidence of violence less frequent, less pervasive, and less indiscriminate than what had been mounting in Baghdad. And in Sulaymaniyye, things worked. Not by Western standards, of course, but compared to the rest of the country, it was encouraging to see how functional Kurdistan was. Elections for the new National Assembly were less than a month away, and the Kurds really seemed to believe that they were part of something momentous. The Kurdish Democratic Party dominated in the two states east, and the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan dominated in Sulaymaniyye itself, but the Kurdish flag, the Italian tricolor rotating 90 degrees, with a golden burst of sun at its center, flew everywhere. On the rare occasions when I saw the Iraqi flag flying, it was the old one, the pre-Saddam one, the one that doesn't have "God is great" written on it. Of course, we believe God is great, Sammy's Kurdish driver told me. We just don't think Saddam should have written it on the flag so that he could pretend to be a champion of the faith. On the day of the engagement, Zahra's father Hassan and I went for a walk. The weather left a bit to be desired. Rain every morning, clouds all day. Exceedingly early sunsets because we were in a deep valley. But the landscape was stunning. Mountains in every direction and covered with a shrubby vegetation similar to that one sees on the mountains of Santa Monica. In fact, it was striking how much Iraq reminded me of Southern California. If the area around Baghdad is like the deserts of Los Angeles, then Sulaymaniyye wound up being like Santa Clarita, where the mountains just start to get big enough to collect snow at the top.
For a man in his 60s, Hassan was an impressive walker. He was also a schoolteacher by trade, and as far as I could tell, perfectly suited to it. Whenever I asked him a question, even something innocuous like, "Is it always cloudy in the winter up here?" he would smile delightedly and say, "Ah, yes. Now that is an excellent question, and there is an amazing story behind the answer." Following which you could expect a 45-minute disquisition that would begin directly related to your query, but then spiral outward to include anecdotes and observations regarding many other intriguing, if not entirely innocuous, matters as well. Thus, in our 3 hours switchbacking up Goiza, we discussed Aristotle, Lamarck, Debussy, Zoroastrianism, Abu Ghraib, Hannah Arendt, and the as-yet-unknown contingencies of de-Ba'athification. Hassan managing, even with respect to more sobering of these topics, to display a certain philosophical resilience. At one point, I said I'd heard there was a new hotel going up in town,
and that this seemed to me a positive sign. And Hassan halted to announce that even if they built 100 new hotels, there wouldn't be sufficient accommodations,
because the number of tourists coming to Kurdistan was going to overwhelm.
No, no, he said, when I look at him askance. Don't think about the present. Think about the future. I wish you were staying with us longer. I'd show you some of the wonderful places we have. In the mountains and the valleys, you'll see, they'll come from everywhere. Think about the future. And yet, if I were to articulate the prevailing impression of the 7 cumulative weeks I spent in Iraq between December 2003 and January 2005, it would be to venture that the future meant something very different there from what it means in, say, America. In Iraq, even in the comparatively auspicious North, the future has long been viewed as a much more nebulous eventuality, if indeed one expects to be around for its eventuality at all. Over dinner on the night of his engagement, my brother was trying to explain to his soon-to-be in-laws about New Year's resolutions. In America, he said, it's traditional for people to promise themselves they'll change aspects of their behavior in the coming year. Zahar's family thought that was crazy. Who are you, they asked, to think you can control your behavior in the future? Well, you know, my brother replied, some things you can control. You can decide you're going to eat more vegetables, or that you're going to exercise more, or that you're going to read a little bit each night before you fall asleep. To which Zahra's mother, an x-ray technician at the teaching hospital, replied, but how do you know you're going to be able to afford vegetables next month? Or who says there won't be a curfew tomorrow preventing you from going to the gym or running in the park after work? Or who says your generator won't give out and then you'll have to read with a flashlight until the batteries die and then with a candle until it burns down and then you won't be able to read in bed at all? You'll just have to sleep, if you can. By contrast, the following day, having driven across the town to check out a used Yamaha my brother had seen advertised online, he and I found ourselves eating breakfast in a cafe next to 3 journalists, 2 American and 1 Scottish, who were telling their driver the plan. First, we want to go here. Then at 11, we'll leave for here. And then at 1:30, we'll go here. The driver listened with brow-furrowing bemusement. It got better. Oh, said one of the Americans, and on the 15th, there's this meeting that I want to go to in Erbil. Now the driver looked as though he'd been asked to drive to Shanghai and back by Tuesday. Erbil was a ways from here. The 15th was a ways from now. In Iraq, when so remote a prospect is raised, a common response is, well, look, God is generous. Meaning, well, okay, fine. Let's talk about it when it's relevant. But if this journalist isn't in Erbil in 2 weeks' time, it's going to come as a surprise to her. In the interim, she's going to plan her life as though she's going to be in Erbil on the 15th. If she learns of another meeting somewhere else on that day, she'll probably say, oh, I can't go to that. I'm going to be in Erbil. Erbil is 2 weeks from now and 120 miles from here. But meanwhile, our resolute American is already then and there in her mind. Well, let us see. God is generous. The Yamaha was a glossy black baby grand that had belonged to a British woman who lived in Sulaymaniyah for 30 years until her husband had died and she'd returned to Shepherd's Bush. In addition, she'd also evidently left behind this disaffected-looking young man, whose biceps implied less interest in the piano he was trying to sell us than in the weightlifting equipment densely arrayed on the Persian rug underneath it. When Sammy asked if he might lift the Yamaha's lid and play a little something to get a sense of its sound, the man gave us a disinterested wave and went back to frying garlic in his kitchen. Unsurprisingly, the piano was out of tune. But instead of discouraging my brother, its dissonance appeared to intrigue him like a benign and fascinating medical mystery to be solved. After a brief flurry of warped Mozart, he pressed and held down one long note after another, then another, and another, presumably to confirm that each on its own had the purity and resonance of a respectable instrument. Only in combination did they jar and jam. Meanwhile, I toured the little room with my hands in my pockets, still thinking about Erbil. I was determined not to contemplate the future, or even the past, but only what was happening to me right now. Which, unfortunately, can be a little like trying to fall asleep and failing to do so because you cannot stop thinking about how you were trying to fall asleep. A poster of Che Guevara rendered in calligraphic Arabic reminded me that I hadn't yet rescheduled a meeting with my Argentinian dissertation advisor. A stack of hablatis on a ring-stained coffee table conjured the ardent recycler I'd broken up with 2 months before. Also on this table were an open can of wild tiger and a porcelain ashtray made to look like a crumpled camel's pack, completing a sort of Kurdish bachelor pad tableau that inevitably led to comparisons with my own hermetic home life. But for a few moments there, distracted by the ashtray's uncanny verisimilitude, I did succeed in not thinking about my singleness, nor about my dissertation, nor about when I was going to learn the results for my latest grant application, and not about the long drive to Baghdad my parents and I were intending to make the following day. I was not even thinking about the drift and worthiness of my thinking. And I suppose another way of saying all this is, I was happy. While Sammy counted out a stack of American hundreds, I stepped over a barbell to approach a piano as if for a better look. Behind it hung a large, gilt-framed mirror that did not, when I caught my reflection in it, fail to disappoint. In that, like all mirrors, it gave back startlingly little a sense of the worlds within worlds a single consciousness comprises. Too dull and static a human surface to convey the incessant kaleidoscope within. Invigorated by my new surroundings, my brisk mountain walks, and the spirit of possibility that accompanied the advent of a year, I'd been feeling in Sulaymaniyya more attuned to life and richer in potential than I'd felt in a long time. Maybe not even since the first summer after college with Maddie. In Sulaymaniyya, unburdened by routine and inspired by my brother's apparent tranquility and contentment, I envisioned myself approaching a kind of bifurcation, a meaningful deviation that would steer my life closer to his and our Iraqi ancestors than ever before. Here was the future. Here was where one of the most important revolutions of my earthly tenure was taking place. And emboldened by the extra passport in my pocket, I wanted to witness it and play a part in its fruition. This is how I felt. But in the mirror on the other side of Sammy's new piano, I didn't look like a man teeming with so much potential. On the contrary, in my 11-year-old jeans, a week's worth of stubble, and a fraying windbreaker from the Gap, I looked rather more like the embodiment of a line I would later read, something about the metaphysical claustrophobia and bleak fate of being always one person. A problem, I suppose, that is entirely up to our imaginations to solve. But then even someone who imagines for a living is forever bound by the ultimate constraint. She can hold her mirror up to whatever subject she chooses, at whatever angle she likes. She can even hold it such that she herself remains outside its frame. The better to de-narcissize the view. But there's no getting around the fact that she's always the one holding the mirror. And just because you can't see yourself in reflection, doesn't mean no one can.
Having agreed on terms of delivery, my brother and the taciturn Kurd were now emptying the piano's bench of its contents.
I watched as out came a stack of old sheet music, some composition paper with a smattering of handwritten notes that ended after only a few bars, and a book of poems by Mohammed Salih Dilan. There was also an antique postcard of the Royal Opera House that my brother lodged admirably into the bottom left-hand corner of the mirror's frame, and a 1977 copy of the portable Stephen Crane. The last item was entrusted to me for the inventory's duration, and after a bit of idle leafing through an experiment in misery, an experiment in luxury, and an episode of war, I landed on this. It perhaps might be said, if anyone dared, that the most worthless literature of the world has been that which has been written by the men of one nation concerning the men of another. The context was an essay written about Mexico in 1895, but under the circumstances, the grievance felt personal and prescient. And in the car on the way back to my brother's, I said it reminded me of something Alistair had once said, about how the more time a foreign journalist spends in the Middle East, the more difficult it becomes for him to write about it. I said that when I'd first heard this, it sounded like an excuse, an alibi for failing to do the hard work of writing well. But that the more time I'd spent with Alistair, and for that matter in the Middle East, the more sympathetic to it I'd become. After all, humility and silence are surely preferable to ignorance and imperiousness. And maybe East and West really are eternally irreconcilable, like a curve and its asymptote geometric fated never to intersect. My brother looked unimpressed. "I see what you're saying," he said, as we slowed for a group of teenagers exiting a fast food restaurant called Madonal. "But wasn't it also Crane who said that an artist is nothing but a powerful memory that can move itself at will through certain experiences sideways?" My parents and I arrived in Baghdad the same day its governor, Ali el-Haydari, and 6 of his bodyguards were assassinated, sinking my optimism and adding to my growing list of differences between North and South that the latter was much more politicized. Though this made sense. Baghdad was the capital. The situation up north was much more stable. And as far as the Kurds were concerned, the election results were a foregone conclusion. Of course, aside from my brother and his driver and Zahra and her relatives, I knew no one in Sulaymaniyya. Whereas in Baghdad, my parents and I were surrounded by my large extended family, who have always been a pretty political bunch. Of my 8 aunts and uncles still living in the city, 2 worked in the Green Zone, and 3, including Zaid, were running for office. But it was also what one saw in the streets, like the billboard at the end of my grandmother's road that read, "So that we might leave a better country for our children." This appeared over a picture of a ballot box and the date on which everyone should vote, making it somewhat difficult not to interpret the caption to mean, yes, for our generation, it's probably a lost cause, a hopeless and terrifying mess. But maybe if we vote first, our children will still inherit a better country. God is generous. Indeed, everyone I observed in Baghdad was afraid, much more than the year before. They were afraid of being robbed, shot, stabbed, taken hostage, or blown apart by an explosion. They weren't going out at night. They were changing their paths to work each day. One afternoon, Zayed's driver noticed that a car, the same car, had been in our sight nonstop the whole way from Hay el-Jihad to el-Jadriya. Sometimes it was ahead of us, sometimes behind, sometimes a lane or two over, but always in our vicinity. Zayed's driver insisted this was probably a fluke, but all the same, he turned off the main road and we drove all around Albaya for a while before getting back on track. It worked. Or rather, it turned out we needn't have worried, or that our casers gave up, or had concluded their reconnoitering for the day. The point is that these things were always on Baghdadi's mind, much more than the year before. The year before, in late 2003 and early 2004, people had been perplexed, wary. Conversations had revolved around questions such as, who are these people and why are they suddenly so interested in bringing us freedom? What do they really want? How long will they stay? By January of 2005, however, the questions at the heart of such discussions had become, why are they such bastards? Were they planning for things to go like this all along? Or is it really possible they are this incompetent? And are they gonna let us run our own country, even if they don't like the Constitution? You went to the moon, one of my uncle's friends reminded me, when he learned I was an American. We know you could fix this if you really wanted to. But I did want to. Didn't I? Or did I only want it to be done? A week earlier, inspired, paradoxically, by the conversation I had with my brother about the seeming futility of just this, I'd renewed my efforts to keep a journal. A New Year's resolution, it's true. But whenever I sat down with it the following week in Baghdad, I was reminded of the moment in The Red and the Black, when the narrator announces that in lieu of a political conversation, the author had wished to put in a page full of dots. This is because politics, in imaginative work, is like a shot in the middle of a concert. The noise is deafening, but it imparts no energy. It doesn't harmonize with the sound of any other instrument. That would show very little grace, warns the author's editor. And if so frivolous a piece of writing lacks grace, it is fatal. If your characters don't talk politics, this is no longer France in 1830, and your book is not the mirror you pretend it to be. Well, I too would have liked to substitute every political conversation I had in Baghdad in January of 2005 with a page full of dots. But if I had, all I would have had at the end of it was a moleskin full of dots. And in any case, my family and their friends and I weren't characters in an imaginative work. We were real people, weathering real lives, in which politics aren't merely like a gunshot in the middle of a music concert. Sometimes they actually are a gunshot in the middle of a music concert, making the urgency one feels in talking about them all the more urgent. Imploringly, as though I had my own line to the Situation Room and the exclusive wherewithal to plead their case, my relatives would describe to me what Baghdad used to look like. They told me that as recently as the 70s, it looked like Istanbul does now, bustling with tourists and business people, a thriving cosmopolitan capital in an ascendant Middle East. Before Iran, before Saddam, before sanctions and Operation Iraqi Freedom, and now this. Theirs, too, had been a country of culture, of education, and commerce, and beauty, and people came from all over to see it and be a part of it. And now, do you see, Amer, this chaos outside our doors, this madness? In the evenings, mindful of the inadequacy of dots, I pored over the books and photographs and letters that my grandfather had saved from his government days. And these, too, described Baghdad vividly at odds with what I saw when I dared to step outside, which was a place in which you could not forget about politics for 1 minute, never mind the time it takes to eat a meal or read a poem or make love. Very little worked. Very little was beautiful. The order and security that undergirded even my unhappiest moments back home seemed here the wondrous luxuries of another world. Baghdad, to borrow four words from If This Is a Man, was the negation of beauty. Around mid-morning on our last day in Iraq, my father and uncle and I returned from visiting Zaid's grandchildren to find we had a visitor. My grandmother made some coffee, and the six of us, including my mother and Zaid, sat around in the front garden and talked. Like most conversations, this one had its lulls, and each time there was a lull, our visitor would attempt to dispel it by saying, "This will pass eventually." It was like a nervous tick, repeated maybe half a dozen times in our presence. "This will pass eventually. This will pass eventually." At one point, after saying it, the man looked up and caught the doubtful expression on my face. "I mean," he said, "it's not as though things can continue like this forever, right?" Under the circumstances, this is what passed for optimism in liberated Baghdad. The vaguely morbid notion that things couldn't possibly go on very awfully indefinitely. In truth, I found it difficult to endure, and even more so when the pervasive dejection was joined by a creeping guilt. The guilt of an inveterately forward-thinking American counting down the days before he and his parents would be boarding their flights home. "But not everyone is fatalistic," Zaid tried to reassure me. "The political activists are smarter and more sophisticated than they were last year. And last year, they were smarter and more sophisticated than they'd been the year before. They see opportunities they've been waiting for decades, and they're moving hard and fast to exploit them. They're thinking ahead while also being mindful of past mistakes. Their political opponents have chosen violence over competition, which means that if people do make it to the polls, they'll win, and they'll write the Constitution, and then the game will be theirs to lose, unless it's stolen from them. A non-trivial condition. If the elections really are free and fair, Americans are not going to like the outcome. But assuming it doesn't get stolen, things will only get harder after the Constitution is writ." I must have looked convinced, or at least open to persuasion, because my mother and father and I had loaded our bags into the car and were coming back up my grandfather's driveway to say goodbye. Zaid pulled me aside and asked whether I might be willing to consider a job in the Green Zone. A friend of his had been named the government's liaison to the UN regarding a fledgling economic project, and the liaison wanted someone he could trust to keep up with the technical aspects of the initiative and advise over the course of its negotiations with the various parties involved. Not dishonestly, I told my uncle that I was flattered and that naturally it would be an honor to help, but also that I couldn't be sure of when I'd be able to make it back to Iraq, as it was becoming of critical importance to my psychological welfare that I prioritize finishing my PhD. "But yes," I added quickly, when I saw the disappointment in his eyes, "I'll think about it." "Think about it carefully," said Zaid, "and let us know your decision as soon as you are able. You are in a unique position to help us, help our country, Amer. You understand as well as anyone that we will not be remade in Amrika's image, but nor should Amrika want us to be. So come back to us. Come back to us soon." This last line he repeated while also giving my shoulder a gentle shake, as if to wake me from a dream. By the summer of 2007, I'd finished my coursework and teaching requirements, and had only to conquer my dissertation, which had been growing at the dilatory rate of one paragraph per day. I decided that Los Angeles was the problem, or rather that my Los Angeles-born addiction to internet browsing was the problem. So I subleased my apartment in West Hollywood and moved for the summer out to a cabin on Big Bear Lake, 100 miles east in the San Bernardino Forest. There, I had a wood stove, mountain views, and an Ansel Adams print on the wall where you'd expect a flat screen to be. The first thing I did after arriving and flushing a spider down the toilet was to move the kitchen table into the living room, where I envisioned myself surrounded by textbooks and data sets, working easily and ingeniously into the night. The second thing I did was to get back into the car and go in search of an internet cafe. I had only just turned out of the driveway when my cell phone beeped, and it was my father calling to tell me that Zaid had been kidnapped. It had happened right in front of his house. His driver had come to pick him up for work and was opening the rear passenger door when another car pulled into the driveway and two men got out
and pointed Kalashnikovs at Zaid's head.
"Tafdal Amu," one of the men said, opening the door to their car. "Be our guest, uncle." The following morning, my aunt, Alia, received a phone call requesting $50,000. "But Karim's offer them half," said my father. "Who's Karim?" I asked. "Our broker." 10 days later, anti-Shiite factions bombed Al-Askari for the second time in 16 months. Curfews were imposed in Samarra and Baghdad, while in retaliation, Shiites set fire to Sunni mosques, and Zaid remained missing. On being hired, Karim had asked my uncle's driver where the kidnappers had put him. "In the front seat," said the driver. "Good," Karim said. "The front seat is good. If you put your hostage in the trunk, you're probably going to kill him, for political reasons. Whereas if you give him the front seat, you don't care if he's Sunni or Shiite. You're just in it for the ransom. And you're looking after your hostage in order to get paid. So, let's negotiate." But as time passed, with only curt and sporadic communication from the kidnappers, followed by even terser and more infrequent instructions from someone who identified himself as Big Yazid and complained he'd bought Zaid from his original captors at too high a price, the more difficult it became to believe Karim's theory was sound. Meanwhile, holed up in my Californian idol, checking and rechecking my phone and listening to the lake water lap placidly at the dock, I was not getting much work done. In the afternoons, I went for long bike rides or loitered in the internet cafe, where I met a girl named Farah, who lived in Fonskin and with whom I went to bed a couple of times before she invited me to a cookout on the 4th of July. It turned out to be a small party, less raucously collegiate than I expected, and while we were waiting for the sun to go down and the fireworks over the lake to begin, someone suggested a game of Pictionary. I was on Farah's team, along with two other women whose sundresses, when they leaned over the table, gaped to reveal the lace trim on their pastel-colored bras. And shortly after I'd removed the cap on my first bottle of beer in 6 years, someone drew an all play. The timer was upended and everyone leaned in, shouting guesses that became predictably louder and more urgent as the sand trickled down. "Person. People. People holding hands. People dancing. Angry person. Mean person. Mean person holding a letter. Parking ticket. Manifesto. Mein Kampf. Karl Marx. Bag. Sack. Money. Robber, bank robber, heist, bandits, Butch Cassidy, Bonnie and Clyde, Dog Day Afternoon, heist." Somebody already said that. "No grunting. Sounds like eyelashes, hair, beautiful, handsome, sounds like handsome, bansome, cansome, dansome, grinsome." At what point, Farah looked up and gave me a meaningful, exacerbated look. Then she drew a car. Then she drew two stick figures holding hands next to the car. Then she drew an arrow between one of the figures and the front seat of the car. Then she X'd out the trunk. "Oh," I said, "kidnap." Widening her eyes, Farah nodded and stabbed her pencil at what looked like a scrunched up paper bag with a dollar sign on it. She was a pretty good drawer. "Ransom!" shrieked the girl on my other side. "Ransom note," someone else shouted, on the other side of the table. He wasn't on our team. Anyway, the sand and the little imitation hourglass had already run down. And when the drawings were passed around for inspection, more than one noble stickler for rules pointed out that symbols, including dollar signs, aren't allowed. I don't remember who won. It tends to be the regrettable things. The details that in retrospect seem to reflect your own pettiness and a certain incurable myopia that you remember most clearly of the prelude to a shock. The next day, my father called to tell me that even though Alia had wired the $40,000 agreed for her husband's release, Zaid's body had been left in a plastic bag under the porch, a bullet
in his head.
Mr. Jafari, would you come here, please?
Slowly, I backed away from Iman Usman's contact details and went to meet Duncan by the door.
I'm afraid it's not good news, he said,
carrot-colored eyebrows straining empathetically.
You are going to be refused entry into the UK today.
I waited.
I'm sorry. I'm afraid my chief is not satisfied that you are not here for reasons you have not disclosed to us. I'm here on a layover to Istanbul. And we have no reason to disbelieve that claim. I'm sorry. I did try to find a loophole for you, I did. But unfortunately, the burden of proof is on the passenger to convince us he's not going to take advantage of the system. Why would I pose a threat?
I closed my mouth.
I'm sorry, he repeated. You just don't qualify today. If you can satisfy another clearance officer in future that you qualify for entry on another day, then your case will be viewed on its merits. This does not automatically exclude you from coming back to the UK in future.
What about tomorrow?
What about tomorrow? Is there a chance I'll qualify tomorrow?
No. So what happens now?
Well, we've spoken with BA, and they have a flight going back to Los Angeles that leaves in 1 hour, which is a bit tight, but if we can get you and your luggage screened and checked in right away, we might be able to get you on that.
Why can't I just stay here?
Duncan smirked.
I'm serious, I said. If I'm trying to get to Iraq, and I'm booked on a flight to Istanbul that leaves here on Sunday morning, is there any reason I can't just stay here, in your detention room until then? Why would I want to go all the way back to Los Angeles?
I'd have to ask.
I wish you would. You might have to sleep in here.
That's fine.
He was gone another hour. Another hour of not knowing. Another 1/24th of a rotation. Another 60 minutes of trying not to think about what I might be doing and what I should have done before. 4 years earlier, when we were hiking up Goiza, on the afternoon of his daughter and my brother's engagement, Hassan had told me that during the good old days, male Ba'ath Party members secretly identified themselves with mustaches that were slightly shorter on one side than the other, like the hands of a clock. Specifically, the left side would be shorter than the right, like a timepiece at 8:20. And as the one on the wall opposite me now crept steadily through the same configuration, my heart began to race and my fingers to go blue with cold. Where was my brother now? Was he comfortable? Was he warm? Did he have food and water and light enough to see a clock? 8:25. 8:30. On the muted television, EastEnders gave way to It's a Wonderful Life. El Dunya Mukhluba. America on Christmas indeed. There is yet another use for El Dunya Mukhluba, by the way, and that is to express disapproval or incredulity, typically with respect to the perceived lunacy of some modern development.
Have you heard there's going to be a black man in the White House?
El Dunya Mukhluba.
The world is upside down. In this spirit, the phrase has an English cousin, The World Turned Upside Down, which is the title of at least two songs with anarchist origins, as well as that of a book by the Marxist historian Christopher Hill, writing about radicalism during the English Revolution. The first song is said to have survived as a ballad published in a British newspaper in 1643, written in protest against Parliament's declaration that Christmas ought to be a strictly solemn occasion, and therefore all happy traditions associated with the holiday, abolished. The angels did good tidings bring, the shepherds did rejoice and sing. Why should we from good laws be bound? Yet let's be content, and the times lament. You see the world's turned upside down. Of course, to the English protesters who wanted to keep their Christmas celebrations, it was Parliament turning the world on its head. To my beautiful cousin, Rania, it was the celebrations themselves. 9:10. 9:15. 9:25. 1,000 miles eastwise. 66,666 to orbit the sun, 420,000 around our galactic center, and 2,237,000 across the universe. Cumulatively, we are traveling through space at 2,724,666 miles per hour, and all of us in near sync, like a flock of starlings swirling patterns through the sky. Anchored, more or less, to the same astronomical non-peril, whose cardinal directions are only a recent invention, specifically by humans who happen to call the northern continents home. The mile and the hour, too, were invented north of the equator. The former by Roman invaders who, marching through Europe, planted a stick in the ground after every mile past them, or 1,000 paces. The latter by the ancient Egyptians, when they divided into 12 segments the sunlit part of the day. Whereas Islam's day begins at sundown. A mile in Imperial Russia was 24,500 feet. Australians measure liquid volume by the amount of water in their most populous city's harbor. It's nothing new. Disunity. Disparity. Terminological conflict. There has always been dissenters. Always those for whom the world is due a revolution, and spilling a little blood is the only way. The problem with the idea that history repeats itself is that when it isn't making us wiser, it's making us complacent. We should have learned something from Yugoslavia, Bosnia, and Somalia, yes. On the other hand, humans kill. They take what isn't theirs, and they defend what is, however little that may be. They use violence when words don't work. But sometimes the reason words don't work is because the ones holding all the cards don't appear to be listening. Whose fault is it then when a good man, a man who works hard and lives in accordance with generous and peaceable principles, can't leave his house in Sulaymaniyah at 5 o'clock in the afternoon to walk a child home from a piano lesson without being kidnapped at gunpoint by men who can conceive of no better way to make $100,000 in American bills? And even more than your brother, Alistair had warned me the night before in an email I'd read standing in line to board my flight, as he would be warning me now in the Lamb, had his exemplary border force seen fit to let me through. Someone like you would be the richest prize these people would ever hope to run across. A Shiite from a political family affiliated with 2 of the political parties they hate, and who's got connections in the Green Zone, and is an American citizen with family in the U.S. and savings and dollars? Can you imagine? So many birds, one stone. All right then, Mr. Jafari, you can stay. But if you're going to be our responsibility for the next 34 hours, we're going to have to get you checked out by a doctor. America is America again, I said to myself the night Obama was elected. I said it not by mistake, but certainly without thinking, without, as Mandelstam wrote of God, having thought to speak.
A little more than 1 month earlier, Eid had fallen on the 2nd of October.
The same evening Joe Biden braved Sarah Palin in the vice presidential debate. The night Palin quoted Ronald Reagan as having said that freedom is always just one generation away from extinction. We don't pass it to our children in the bloodstream. We have to fight for it and protect it, and then hand it to them so that they shall do the same, or we're going to find ourselves spending our sunset years telling our children and our children's children about a time in America, back in the day, when men and women were free. But Reagan hadn't been talking about national security. He'd been speaking in 1961 on behalf of the Women's Auxiliary of the American Medical Association about the perils of socialized medicine, specifically Medicare.
I was alone on Eid in my apartment in West Hollywood, breaking the fast with some kleitsche my mother had sent me. And as my dissertation was due to my advisor the following morning, I was struggling to install a new ink cartridge with which to finish printing its 43 pages of tables and notes. Meanwhile, listening to Governor Palin fire off her arsenal of errata, I began to wonder whether I hadn't left it too late to go into politics after all. If you don't like the way things are, change them. No use sitting around rolling your eyes. All that is necessary for the triumph of evil is that good men do nothing, etc. But then Obama won, and suddenly I did like the way things were, and were going to be, provided the damage done by his predecessors didn't prove too tenacious or even irreparable. The political depression I'd suffered for nigh on 8 years had lifted, and I even dared to imagine that the apparently superior qualities of our president-elect would ingratiate us anew beyond our shores. Or do those who hate us even care whom we vote into office? Or does our having elected someone who would seem to be intelligent and well-spoken, charming and prudent, far-sighted and diplomatic, and altogether enviable leader only make them hate us more? The socialized medic examining me now was a pleasant man,
gentle, efficient, and studiously indifferent to my crimes, whatever they were. But it was nonetheless a peculiar experience, this undergoing a checkup when I didn't need one, when I hadn't the mildest complaint other than the agony of my helplessness, when the